Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, our weekly unfiltered episode. Rabia here, and I'm here with my colleagues and friends, Mito and Colin. Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Getting
Not
by.
Bad. Can't complain.
I was traveling for an upcoming season that's coming up to investigate that case. And while I was in Pennsylvania, a snowstorm hit where I was. But when I got back to Maryland, it seemed okay. Mito, what about for you?
Yeah, I mean, the kids were home yesterday, but we got 3 inches that you could pretty much just blow away with your mouth. So that was fun.
Right. Yeah, the kids didn't have school yesterday either. And I got back and I'm like, wait, why? There's nothing happening. What about you, Colin? Were you guys in the storm path?
No, we're far enough south that we avoided the snow.
Is it like 75 degrees there?
I mean,
right,
it's
now
cooled off, but I can't complain. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm hoping this is the last go around. But anyhow. All right. So, Mito, we are going to, as always, I think this is going to be a weekly thing now. Let's start off with a update on Nancy. On the Guthrie case. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. I really didn't think that I would still be providing updates on this case 4 weeks in now and counting, apparently, because
we're going to do this until, there's some resolution. I think it just makes sense. Yeah.
I mean, so basically last week, I talked about how they had found some DNA and were able to rule out, the family members and anyone close in her immediate circle. They've added it to CODIS, no hits. So basically the next option that they're pursuing is forensic genealogy. No clue how long that's going to take. So, we'll wait on that. And then, in addition to that, they're still trying to figure out, okay, where did this suspect get the backpack from? Okay, it looks like it's from Walmart, so they're checking local Walmarts. And they're still trying to identify the suspect, basically. But unfortunately, after, at least 50,000 leads, they still have not been able to identify him.
Okay, I've heard a couple of weird things, including one where, a helicopter flyover was able to identify like a pacemaker signal, which is, first of all, wait, what is this technology? But have you heard anything about that?
No.
Okay. I need to forward you every single thing that I come across then. Something I saw, but the video I saw was a man who was talking about, can we talk about the technology that's being employed in this case? Because wait, we didn't know that the police had such technology that they could pick up a pacemaker signal. Now, I didn't go into the backstory behind what he was saying because I was listening to basically him talk about the ethics of some of this and some of these investigative tools. Okay, so you haven't heard about that. We'll go back. I don't think it was actually connected to her, but it was just something they were able to pick up these signals. And I guess does she have a pacemaker? Do we know that?
Yeah. Remember, it stopped syncing to her iPhone.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. So maybe that's one of the technologies they're using to try to find her. But
I was just gonna say the other thing that they're looking at is obviously, other cameras that were on her property. But the problem with that is they've, been overwritten. So now they're working with Google to see if there's a way that they can revert the copy. But again, that goes into ethics.
Wait, but they're not overwritten immediately. I mean, they knew by the next morning that she's gone.
But maybe they didn't try to get to it at that time, or maybe she didn't have the right subscription package or that kind of thing.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. I mean, I'm also, but okay, that camera in the front of her house also, that was another thing this guy was talking about, was the fact that it was my camera also will, as far as I know, does not record constantly. It just records when something's happening or there's something, but her settings were they were able to retrieve footage when they should not have been able to get footage from that camera, which means that it's recording constantly. So why wouldn't the others be recording? I guess it kept recording over it or something.
Yeah. And I did see something in there related to what type of package she had for her camera subscription.
Okay. What about that one thing I sent you about the book?
The book.
Savannah wrote a book.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. I don't know, man. Here's the thing. There's
conspiracy theories, right?
So many conspiracy theories. And there's so many internet sleuths that are in Tucson right now, right? So it's just what's legitimate, what's not.
Oh.
And that's kind of also part of the problem because the authorities are like, hey, that's great that you guys are really enthusiastic about finding Nancy, but can we do our work and actually find her instead of you guys just kind of mucking things up? Obviously, they're doing other things.
Well, I mean, what do you think about that, though, Colin? Because, I mean, there have been lots of cases in which citizen sleuths have, in fact, found important evidence and broken cases even.
Including some of our own, right?
Yeah,
Where
yeah,
we've
yeah.
heard cases and other podcasts, and they've uncovered things. So don't want to interfere, but it can certainly be value added, I think.
Yeah. Or like you said, a lot of mud in the water, like conspiracy theories. Like, so there was a book that's apparently Savannah Guthrie had written, and that's her daughter. And I don't think it was a fiction book. It was a book about kind of like their life, or maybe it was an autobiography or something like that, in which she talked about like kind of this game that existed in her family, in which like they would do these like fake kidnappings amongst one another. And it was just like a game they grew up doing. I'm like, this doesn't feel like that for sure. This feels very, very real.
Yeah.
But all kinds of weird theories are coming out. All right, so I guess basically there's really nothing significant, no significant developments. All right. I know you have another story for us, Mithil. We'll circle back to you, but I figure I'll start off this week. So this was a story that was just published in the most recent issue of The New Yorker, and the author's Ava Kaufman, journalist Ava Kaufman, just wrote this. It was just published last week. And it's a story that I think is kind of crazy. I think it raises some really interesting ethical questions. Does it fall into the realm of true crime? I don't know, but it feels ish, I guess. All right. So it starts off, well, at least the reporting starts off February 2024 with a young woman by the name of Kayla Elliott from Texas. And she was in a Facebook group that was for people, women who are interested in being surrogates. And she posted that she's interested in being a surrogate. Okay. An agency from Los Angeles contacts her, and it's called the Mark Surrogacy Agency, and said, "Look, we've got a couple. They're interested in your profile. It's a Chinese couple there, but they're here in the U.S. And the husband is 64 years old. The wife is 36. The husband's name was Ju. Okay, I'm gonna mess this up. Guojun, Guojun, Guo, Guojun." Zwan, okay, and the wife Sylvia. I'll do my best with that, but please feel free to correct me, listeners. Anyway, Kayla goes through all of the screenings she has to do. She gets a psych evaluation. She has four kids of her own, but this is the first time she's doing becoming a surrogate, and she gets all the hormonal injections, all the protocols in order to receive the embryo transfer. Now, when she now and this time, she's like, she was told that the couple wants to treat her as part of the family and all this stuff. And the couple has one daughter already, but the daughter wants a sibling. And yeah, but during this time, she's not really contacted by them a lot. The day of the transplant, only the husband shows up. Zuan shows up. Sylvia does not show up. And so she's a little confused. She's got a couple people from the agency with her. Anyhow, the transplant is successful. And the pregnancy's viable, and then she is 17 weeks along, and she sees another post on Facebook about the same agency, in which a woman who is also a surrogate is like, "I am right now carrying a baby for this same couple," and she's like, "Wait a minute, that's weird." So she reaches out to the woman, direct messages her, and the woman's like, "Yeah, I'm also carrying for her, but the couple has 13 kids already." And Kayla's like, "Wait a minute, they told me they had one daughter." So she reaches out to the agency. They're like, "Oh yeah, well, I mean, they actually want a really big family, so they're working with lots of different surrogates." Anyhow, March 13th, 2025, a year ago, Kayla has a baby girl. Neither the husband or wife show up during the delivery. Like later that night after midnight, Sylvia shows up. It's the first time she meets Sylvia, drops a bunch of cash on Kayla, and like Kayla's family's all there, and takes the baby and leaves. She's trying to figure out like what's going on, because she wants to like have some connection to the family, know how the baby's doing. She texts Sylvia. Sylvia does send her some pictures and stuff, and she's like, "Yeah, we named the baby, and we named the baby, and the baby is doing fine." Sends her a couple pictures, and then kind of drops off. Okay. Well, what happens is that a bunch of time goes by, and she's not able to get in touch with Sylvia, and she's like, "What's going on?" She finally hears from her, and Sylvia's like, "Oh, me and my husband were in jail for a few days. We're out now, and the baby, I can't send you any pictures because the baby's in state custody." And Kayla's like, "Wait, why is the baby in state custody?" So Kayla, of course, she has enough information about the baby she delivered. So she contacts a caseworker in LA County at the Department of Children and Family Services and says, oh, well, the baby was taken away because one of this couple's other infant children was hospitalized recently with a bunch of injuries. And that baby had 20 siblings in the home, including the one that Kayla had given birth to, most of them under 3 years old. All of them, including her child, has been taken into foster care. And of course, they're looking at the injuries this child has, which seem consistent with him actually. The couple's like, oh, he fell, but that's not what it looks like. He's pretty serious. A police affidavit becomes public. And in that police affidavit, you can see pictures of the child. He's hospitalized. He's got like a brace on his head, a breathing tube. And the police actually are like, well, we are, you know, they're investigating what happened to the child. So they go into the house and it's like this man, it's like a 10,000 square foot mansion, all right, in LA County. And they find 20 children in there, okay? They find like this weird classroom set up. There's a bunch of people working. They're like nannies. The kids all have their heads shaved, okay? They're all like dressed in like the same kind of little, I don't know, uniform thing. So they go through the camera footage, and what they see is that the baby that was hospitalized was, in fact, abused by one of the nannies. He was hit a number of times and then appeared unconscious after that. But they arrested the couple because they saw that the couple, in the surveillance footage, they see the couple themselves reviewing the surveillance footage and seeing that the baby had been hurt, not taking him in for treatment, not contacting the police. In fact, telling the nanny, here's some money, you leave now. Just go away. We don't want to get the police involved. Anyhow, Sylvia and Zwan are arrested, but then they're like, you know, they're let go. And because like now this is turning into a full blown, like an investigation, and they're trying to figure out what is actually happening in this family. Is this a child trafficking ring or what? You know, because obviously, especially given like what we've been hearing in the last, you know, couple of years, it seems likely that that could still happen. Now, as this story is breaking, all these other surrogates for this family start finding each other online and they create a group, right? And they're trying to figure out what's going on. Where are the children we had? What's happening to them? The police don't give them a lot of information because they can't. And also, legally, these surrogates have no rights to these children, frankly. They're called, this group calls themselves, or at least the report identifies them as the Mark surrogates. Some of them are still pregnant and about to have the babies. And they're like, wait, what happens now? Are we going to have the baby and turn it over to the couple? We have contracts signed, all this stuff. Now, here's the crazy thing about, because I did not know how this works in this country, is that there is very little regulation over surrogacy. Very little regulation. In fact, New York is the only, if I want to open a surrogacy agency in Maryland, I can do it today.
No license or anything.
There's no, only New York requires a license. No other state requires a license. And a lot of times you can have surrogacy, you can hire a surrogate without any agency involved. You don't, it's not like adoption where you have to have an agency. You can just find a surrogate, contract between each other, like you're contracting for any other business contract. They turn over the baby. Once that's done, the baby is yours. And you know, pay you, it's between you and the surrogate what you're paying for and the compensation and all that kind of stuff. And that's it. There is almost zero regulation in any of this. Yeah. It turns out that this surrogacy agency is actually owned, obviously, by Sylvia herself. Sylvia owns it, but she's actually not married to Zwan. And I don't know if I'm saying his name, last name right. It's X-U-A-N. Correct me if I'm saying that wrong. Okay. That's who he is. So she's not actually married to him. They do have one child together, but all the other children are children that he wanted. Why? Because he's basically a super wealthy, powerful man. He left China because of some investigations, but he left very wealthy. Sylvia also fled China for different reasons, and she began doing real estate work, and he found her, and they came across one another, and he owns, I mean, he has like over 50 LLCs registered. They're all kind of like shell companies that buy property and sell property. It's all done on cash. Sylvia's involved, all super shady stuff, but the guy's got tons of money. Mm-hmm. And as they're investigating this, authorities are realizing that there's, in fact, no trafficking going on at all. He just wants a lot of babies. He wants a ton of children. And,
Whoa.
you know, it's not unlike Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk, who has 14 children with four different women, and he wants to, he's not done. He said he wants to, Musk himself says, I want to reach Legion level before the apocalypse. We're going to use surrogates, we're going to do whatever. Another rich guy, the Russian founder of Telegram, has said that he believes the propagation of his genes is a civic duty. He has six kids naturally, but he's fathered more than 100 through his sperm donations. He has plans to give them all access to his fortune. There's a video game billionaire in China who said that in response that he has conceived more than 100 children through surrogacies, 12 of them carried out in the U.S. I mean, this is a thing. You know, rich people are like, what can we buy? Well, rich people are buying babies too, but their own babies for themselves. And apparently, according to like employees and staff that worked with them, Zwan was like, he had all kinds of crazy ideas. He's like, you know, he thought if I have enough kids, I'm increasing the odds of one of them becoming the president of the United States. He named a lot of the kids after presidents like Jefferson, and like a lot of the kids had names named after presidents. He had said that if he had been born in the U.S., he wanted to be president. There is a bit of the what kind of complex is this? This is called something. There's something diagnosable about this. He carried a card that he's like he was a Trump Doge member, official Trump cabinet member. He had some kind of a business card that said official Trump cabinet member and Trump advisor, although there is no actual official record that he had any connection to the Trump administration. Anyhow, so they take these kids in. You know, they're examining them, and you know, the kids are not, and they, and it wasn't like no social workers had gone through there before. There had been reports to the police in the past that we think kids are experiencing neglect, this and that. And they had social workers go through there. They're like, oh, generally they seem okay to us. But after all this went down and they actually, the state took custody of them, a lot of them had like scratches, you know, scars, bruises here and there. One was like dehydrated. Some of them were dirty. And I'm like, you know, if I had four little kids in my house, you would probably find some of them dirty and maybe some scratches here. I mean, this is if you have a bunch of little kids, you know, unless you're running like a professional childcare service where you have lots of people, you know, taking care of them, it's unlikely that all of them are going to be taken care of really, really well. They did what they didn't, you know, one had untreated asthma, one had like, you know, an infection, ear infections, things like that. What they didn't find was evidence of like actual physical abuse. It looked like neglect, which would not be uncommon because you have this many children, right? Now, the couple is fighting for these kids. They want them back, okay? And like litigation on this is ongoing. And in fact, the couple themselves have sued two surrogates now who are still carrying the babies because they're like, we're not going to give them to you. Or one actually, I think one had the baby and they're like, we want the baby. Like they're still fighting. They want babies numbered 23 and 24 and 25. They're fighting for those kids. As far as the Mark surrogates themselves, they're trying to figure out like what rights do we have? They thought, okay, there was obviously some material misrepresentation in the whole contract and stuff. No lawyer wants to touch it. They also can't afford lawyers. Many of them obviously are becoming surrogates because they need the money. They can't afford to hire private lawyers. And the lawyers are like, we don't see any money in this. And also, they don't see a likelihood of even necessarily winning these cases, right? So what's happening now is, and okay, on the money part, well, okay, the guy does have some ties. He had money from China, but he has ties to some shady drug and gambling figures here in the US as well. Anyhow, like, yeah, he works mostly in cash. And when that happens, you know how it is. So, you know, this brings up a bunch of different questions, which one is like, obviously, there's a system failure here, right? Like, a lot of people have to turn a blind eye in order for something like this to happen. In the past, when social workers have gone through, they should have picked up some of the signs of what's happening. But I guess one of my questions is, if a social worker goes through a home and that home has 21 children to begin with, is that alone a red flag? What do you guys think? With their heads shaved in like classroom-like settings?
You would think, but I would think it also depends on how many cases they have, right?
Hmm.
If a lot of these social workers are obviously overworked. Like, they might be like, I mean, they look okay. Sure, that's different that they're wearing uniforms and have their heads shaved, but like, generally speaking, they look okay. Maybe they would overlook that and not note it.
I mean, the one child that the couple had separately before all these surrogates, I mean, she had her own bedroom, but all the other kids were like, I mean, sharing like barrack style bunks, right? Like, but again, is that illegal? I mean, what do you say about that to the, what is it, the Duggars who had like 19 kids
Yeah.
or whatever, right? Colin, what do you think?
I think it's definitely a yellow flag, right? Wanna pursue it further and see what's going on. As you said, I don't know if it's illegal, but it is certainly something where I would want to inquire further and get to the bottom of what's going on. And to your point, Robbie, I can't believe that there's not licensing, certification, et cetera. I mean, someone here wanted to be a realtor, a real estate agent in South
Yeah.
Carolina, and there's all these hoops to jump through, but to run a
Colin, if I want to do nails, if
surrogacy.
I want to become a nail tech,
Yeah, right.
I have to get qualified and get licensed for that. So it's just shocking. I do think the fact that it's her own agency and then she's posing as a couple. I mean, that's one of the issues obviously the surrogates have raised publicly, but it's not something they've raised legally. But they, I don't think, have broken any laws by doing it like this, is the thing. Right now, the one all the daughter that's theirs is with them, but the other kids are like in foster care all across the country. There's a couple of them in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, in Los Angeles, and there's a judge who actually, I think the hearing is like next month, and he said that it, so in the next he's going to decide whether or not like the couple gets all 20 of the kids back. In terms of the child who actually ended up hospitalized, I don't know if they're pursuing criminal charges against the nanny, and I don't know to what extent they're going to be held liable for the fact that they failed to report. But again, there was no evidence that they themselves abused any of the children. And this does also raise a question for me about like what the reason there's like not all these legal kind of guardrails around this is because we're looking at, I guess the law is looking at this as a strict business transaction, which raises the question of what should we be allowed to sell?
But I mean, we have laws against selling
Our own
used
children.
cars. I mean, like
Oh, right.
lemon
Oh, I,
laws, right?
right.
Selling used cars and fraud and the inducement. So, I mean, if you're going to regulate the selling of used cars and other commodities that you're selling, I mean, certainly I would say they should be regulating surrogacy and the contracts that are involved with that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, like at the end of the day, yeah, I do believe a woman has a right if she wants to be a surrogate to become a surrogate and be compensated, but having the regulations to protect the child to make sure that there's transparency in all of this and you actually know where that child's going, how it's being treated, but I and then having some kind of recourse, maybe surrogate contracts can allow for something like that where like if that surrogate family or the surrogate mother is like, if I don't feel the child's being taken care of, I have a right to challenge the. But the problem is that surrogates have like no legal rights here. These are gestational surrogacies. So like they have no genetic connection to the child at all. What do you think, Mithil?
I mean, what doesn't make sense though is if this guy's got so much money and wants to, have all the presidents live in his house and, they're all, his kin, you've got money. Why don't you have equal amounts of nannies for all of your children? Because you want them to grow up and be presidents. Like, why are you not taking care of them?
Why aren't they cared for better?
Yeah, and you money is not an issue for you. So why don't you have 15 nannies? But also, if you're not the one who harmed that baby, why didn't you get them whatever health?
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. This is not these rich men who are having dozens or hundreds of children, however they're having them, also have no, forget, they might have a genetic connection. They have no emotional
Sure,
connection to
sure.
these children. So, like in the last year or so, even though all these kids are being put in foster care, and some of them are even local, they're in LA. So, the couple has been granted the right to visit some of them. And what what's being reported is that when they go and visit, they can't identify the children by their names. They don't know who is who. The guy just sits there, doesn't even touch the kids. Sylvia will once in a while touch the children. They have no, they're just a product that they, it's like a consumer product that they have bought and shelved. There's no, and I think for them, I mean, if I'm understanding like what this guy is trying to, the way he's thinking of, right? Like, it's a survival of the fittest. The sick kids can be sick and just, you know, not survive. The ones who turn out the brightest, the ones who turn out to be, you know what I mean? Maybe that'll be the ones that I, but there's no, even when police were reviewing the footage, they're like, these people spend no time with their kids. There's no emotional connection here. It is a weird, ego-driven, I don't know. It's, but it also begs the question for me is like, about the right of people to have as many kids as they want. Look, Meethal, you and I come from a homeland where at least 100 years ago, people would have 8, 10, 15 kids because a third of them would die anyways, right? Like, that's why.
Right.
But they did have really big families, and there's no regulations around that. I mean, what if this couple goes on and says, we're going to surrogate 100 more in our home? Is there any, like, should there be any limits around this? What do you think?
I mean, I think it starts, like, forget about surrogacy. I think there should be some type of licensing just to be a parent, because not everybody with one child should have one child. So I'll take it all the way back there.
Yeah.
So, but in terms of something like this, it's an agency, absolutely, there should be regulations and there should be some, you know, checks and balances.
Should a family have a limit as to how many kids they can have? Whether they're their own, whether they gave birth to them or they had them through a surrogate?
I think so, but I think that should be based on how they're providing for those children. Can you afford to do so? Are you, emotionally available? Or are they taking
care
of?
If you're not the one,
is somebody else there to fulfill those needs that they have, you know? You can have 50 as long as they're all well taken care of.
Well, there has been one law proposed in response to the story breaking, but it comes out of Florida. And it was a bill that was literally just introduced. But it's interesting because it has kind of not a lot to do with regulation in the way we're looking at it. What he wants to do, this is Senator Rick Scott, who's from Florida, as we know. He wants to ban parents from certain countries, including China, from hiring American surrogates, because this is another thing. In the surrogacy kind of like space, almost in the last, since 2014, I think at least a third of the surrogates' mother, American mothers who are hired by foreign parents. Why? Because we have no regulations here and it's easy to do so. So this year, Senator Scott wrote a letter to the Department of Homeland Security saying that he is concerned about the use of surrogacy by, quote, individuals linked to the Chinese Communist Party. And he said this presents a national security risk. Now, I don't know if I go that far. I don't know about the national security risk here, but it's weird. It's weird that America is becoming like the shopping mall for surrogates with no training wheels on it. Anyway, that's the story I wanted to share. I knew nothing about this whole world. I was shocked to learn about it. But I guess there's a market there as well. There you go. Any other thoughts? Any thoughts about the story that you want before we move on?
Besides insanity? I mean, and you said New York is the only state that does have some type of regulation?
They have some type of licensing.
Licensing.
No. I mean, I don't even know what that looks like. It could be very minimal. It could be filling out a form and you get a license and then you can go about your way. And you know, what an agency generally does is find the parents who need a surrogate and connect and find a surrogate. Match the profiles, make sure they work out, make sure the surrogate gets, like, you know, all the medical, you know, evaluations and screening she needs, and then set it up and take their cut. You know what I mean? Like, it's a middleman for the families.
You would think it would be similar to how an adoption agency would run, right?
I mean, adoption agency, it is hard to adopt a child from,
it
you
should
know,
be.
Friend. Yeah, and it costs tens and tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, this also is not cheap for the family, but the costs are, like, directly paid to, like, this. And maybe that's why Sylvia's like, I'm starting my own agency. I don't want a middleman I got to pay extra money to.
Crazy.
I don't know. All right. Colin, I'm going to pass the baton to you. What do you have for us this week?
Yeah, well, sticking with New York, this is the story of Dr. Noah Bedell. He's a neurologist. He lives in Nebraska, and he's in New York City for a medical convention. Unfortunately, he has a history of mental health issues, including a prior suicide attempt. And so while he's at this hotel in New York City, he sends his wife text messages indicating that he's planning to take his life. He takes a photo of himself staring down from the ledge outside of his hotel room. And so the wife tells this to Dr. Noah's sister. She's a mental health professional. At 6:40 p.m., the sister calls the hotel and asks them to check on the husband, Dr. Noah. Front desk clerk and another employee come up. They go to the hotel room. They see the doctor, empty liquor bottles and pill containers. He tells them, "I'm fine. I don't want to be disturbed." So it's 6:46 p.m. now. The front clerk calls the wife and says, "Your husband is fine." It's now 7:12 p.m. The doctor sends text messages to his wife and sister, including one that seems to be saying goodbye to them. Sister calls the hotel again, says, "I'm a mental health professional." She asks for the police to be contacted immediately. The police department is right next to the hotel. She asks for her brother to be placed on a 72-hour hold. In response, the hotel staff says, "Sure, we'll call the police." 15 minutes pass without them calling the police. They then call up and say, "Are you sure you want us to call the police?" "Yes, we want you to call the police."
Why didn't she call the police?
She says, "I relied upon the hotel saying they'd do it." That's a question in the case, right, in terms of liability. So it's now about 7:27 p.m. 15 minutes have passed. Records show it's another 10 minutes, 7:37 p.m. The hotel finally calls the police. The police arrive. There's a hotel engineer. They break the lock on the door. They see the doctor. He's drunk. He's distraught. He's on the ledge. They try to talk him down. He's inconsolable. He jumps, takes his life, commits suicide.
Oh, boy.
And so the family sues the hospital for wrongful, the hotel for wrongful death. They make three claims. So first they say, Robbie, it's your point. We relied upon the hotel's promise to call the police, leading to us not calling the police ourselves. Mm. Second, they say when the hotel agreed to call the cops, they adopted a duty of care on behalf of the doctor. And then three, they have three experts, mental health experts, reviewing the text messages. And they all say he wasn't firmly settled on suicide. If the police had come 15 to 25 minutes earlier, if they had called promptly, that very well could have stopped the suicide.
Sure.
And so last week, this goes to the state Supreme Court in New York, the Court of Appeals in New York. And the question is, can this case go to a jury trial or is the judge going to dismiss it? And a majority of the court says, we're going to dismiss it. We find the hotel did not have a duty of care to this guest. And if we were to adopt a duty of care, that would disincentivize hotels from trying to take care of the guests. Mm. The dissent disagrees and says, no, they promised to call the police. They waited 25 minutes in total that potentially prevented the family from calling it. We think it's at least a jury issue for the jury to decide whether the hotel is liable. And so those are my questions in terms of this opinion. Who got it right? The majority, the dissent. If you were the judge, would you have sent this to a jury to consider it? Or do you think the majority got it right that there was no duty of care by the hotel?
So right now, this is a criminal matter, right?
It's civil. It's a civil wrongful death action.
It's a civil wrongful death.
Yeah. I think I'm with the majority.
No duty of care by the hotel. They should have called regardless, the family, the police.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's okay that they asked the hotel to do so, but they have hundreds of guests, right? There was no way for her to know when they would call. Maybe they would call immediately after hanging up, or maybe another guest came up to their front desk and they had to handle that. So, I mean, I think they still she still should have called.
Yeah, I also think I agree with the majority that the hotel should not have a duty to care. What's weird to me though is that the majority said that if we impose a duty of care, it will disincentivize. Am I saying that right? Mm-hmm. Hotels from caring for their guests. But I'm like, would it really? Wouldn't it actually make them be like, well, we got to take care of them now? Don't you think so? Like that's what I don't understand. I don't understand that part of the rationale.
Yeah, I think their point is, if they get calls from family members, can you check on my loved one? They'd say, listen, that's on you. It's not on us because if we do something and then you're not satisfied with what we did, we could be sued. I think that's the reasoning that they used.
Oh, okay. See, I guess I expected that if a duty of care was found to like exist, then if somebody calls and says, I need you to check, that the hotel must then check. Not that we don't want to be involved. Gosh,
Right.
I don't know.
What do you think about the fact when they go up there at first, there's empty pill bottles and liquor bottles, the doctors just say, I'm fine, and all the hotel relays to the family is, he's fine. And they don't say, there
I
are a bunch of
mean,
empty pill bottles and liquor bottles. Does that change anything?
look, I think hotel staff probably see a lot of empty liquor bottles in their rooms and pill bottles in their rooms, but the
True. Right.
context matters, right? The context here, it's I think they did not act right, but I don't think they acted
In a way that's
like
actionable, legally.
right in a way that's actionable or criminally. I think that's like where I fall on this, but I'm baffled by the fact that the sister or the wife themselves didn't call. Like, why would you leave it to like somebody you don't even know at a
Right.
front desk at a hotel? I mean, I wouldn't
I can't
trust.
wrap my head around the not calling myself
Yeah.
in this
So
circumstances.
I have to agree with them. How do you feel about this, Colin?
I'm kind of on the same page as both of you. I can't understand why the family didn't call themselves, regardless. I would never rely on any third party to make that call under these
Yeah.
circumstances. In terms of
Yeah.
the hotel, yeah, I mean, I think there's some factual questions as Methil raises. Is this a case where they promised to call and then they got busy and didn't do it? Or was it just, you know what, we checked on them before. I really don't feel like calling again. And that ends up in this delay. I mean, that might be a little bit different in terms of how I feel.
Yeah, but I also think a promise, even a promise made by somebody working at the front desk is not does not imply a duty. Like it doesn't like establish a duty necessarily, right? Do you think it
That's
does?
what
It's
the
a problem.
majority finds. Yeah, it
Yeah.
doesn't establish a duty. I mean, I guess that gets to the broader question of how much of a duty does a hotel
Right.
owe to their guests, regardless,
I mean, this is very similar to the question of like, with bars and like people who are getting drunk and then leaving. Are you making sure every single one is not getting in their own car? And
Right.
like how, to what extent does any private establishment have the duty to care for everybody, every client or consumer or customer they have?
Yeah, I mean, how does that compare, Robbie, to your point? We have these lawsuits where, there's a fatal car accident and the victim's family sues the bartender or the bar and says, listen, you knew closing time was coming, that this person would have to drive home, and you served them when they were blackout drunk. You continue to give them alcohol. Is that analogous or different in your mind from this situation?
No, I think, I mean, to me, it's analogous. I mean, you can't, like, if you have a paying, if you have a customer in your bar that is paying, like, I mean, like, it's, I guess you can make it, you might have a policy, as a private business, that like, we just don't serve more than like 5 drinks to any, I don't know, like something, like, we get to decide. But I don't think there's a legal duty for a bartender to be like, I have to make sure this person gets home safe. Or I have to make sure this person is not like legally intoxicated. Like, how do you don't know what that person's doing when they walk out. They don't have the human resources to follow everybody home to see how they're getting transportation or to check everybody before they leave the door. It's just
Yeah.
like it's just a huge burden. I don't think that is
Yeah.
practical.
And then
And
last
it's,
question,
yeah.
which is okay, let's shift the facts again and say there's someone being harassed and abused in the bar, and the bouncer at the bar isn't doing anything and isn't protecting this patron from being attacked. Is that similar to this hotel case, or is that dissimilar in your minds? We're not, in the car crash, it's outside of the bar where this is happening. Here, this is inside the bar. Does that change it at all?
I think it changes because that's his job. You didn't do your job. Your job, you're there to make sure that, no one's getting hurt or if you need to get somebody out.
Right, but
Right.
the consequence of failing to do your job is that you get fired from your job. Right? I mean, like, what duty does that, like, the bouncer has a duty to the
Yeah.
employer. I don't know if he has a duty to somebody who's in the establishment. I don't know. I think that's a stretch too. What do you think, Colin?
I mean, it's really tough as I was thinking through this and trying to look at these analogous situations. I think in the end, I land in the same spot I think that both of you do, which is, this is a horrible tragedy. I wish the hotel would have communicated more in the initial call and been prompter in calling the police. I don't think it rises to legal liability and that they should be responsible for the death in this case. That's kind of where
I mean, I look, you know, the market will speak for itself. People are going to be like, well, that sucks that your hotel did that. It's bad publicity. Yeah. And that's how, you know, but I think I'm going to have to side with the majority on this. Interesting questions. All right, Mital, you got a story for us before we wrap up?
I mean, it's a case that actually was from 2024. I'm sure you guys would remember it. Colt Gray, 14-year-old, went to his school, shot and killed 4 people, injured 9.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, so just last week, his father was also arrested. So both Colt and his father, Colin Gray, were arrested and charged. And so last week, the father, Colin, appeared in court because his trial has begun. The son, the teenager, his trial, there's no date yet. So basically, you know, the father, Colin, he faces 2 counts of second-degree murder, 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter, 20 counts of cruelty to children, and 5 counts of reckless conduct. If he's found guilty, it's 180 years.
Holy crap.
But, you know, I remember following this case when it first came out. And so the fact that the father is now on trial, I'm just curious to see how it goes. Because I remember when this first happened, it was, oh, okay, so now are all parents going to get charged if their child goes and, you know, shoots up their school or something like that. But what makes this different is the prosecution is saying that the father knowingly gave his son a rifle, something similar to an AR-15. Knowing that he had made threats previously and basically just kind of downplayed it. So,
We covered this case, I think, in Robbie and Ellen as well. And that's what complicates that case. It's not like this came out of left field. The parents have been called into the counselor's office, into the principal's office before. Like, this kid was drawing all kinds of scary things, making threats, like, you know, and by the way,
right.
Telling his parents that I am depressed, I need help. He was asking to be like medicated. He's like, I need something. Like, I cannot regulate for whatever reason. So they didn't get him the help that he needed. And then they, they made the situation worse by exacerbated. Why am I trying to use words I can't use today? Exacerbated the situation by, giving him access to a weapon. But 184 years, is that what you said?
180
years.
Yeah.
That's setting an example, right, Colin? That's what that's doing.
I mean, I think this is, you know, obviously very different factually, but analogous to my story, which is to what extent are we holding someone liable for someone else's actions? And I think both of you kind of hit the nail on the head here of, you know, I wouldn't be comfortable with criminal liability if this is just, look, parent trying to do the best they can, and sometimes their kid is going to do a horrible act. Whereas, Robbie, as you noted, there are some facts in this case that make it different. And I don't know enough about all the facts to be able to say, but I think there are certainly some circumstances in which, if there's a school shooting, the parent might be criminally liable if they knew about what their child had said, gave them a firearm, et cetera.
Yeah, to some extent.
Yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah, 180 years, that's, yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But I wonder, why wasn't the mother charged? You know, the father's being charged because, sure, he gave his son a rifle. He purchased a rifle for him, but the mom knew. The mom called the morning of the actual shooting to raise the alarm, saying, hey, he's sending some questionable text messages. And so the resource officers went to find him. Too late, but how come she wasn't also charged?
Well, I think the two kind of critical facts are, one, the father giving the gun, and then, Mital, what you just mentioned, where the mom actually was concerned. Now, she was too late in the end, but she at least was taking some affirmative steps to try to prevent this, because she saw that this was a powder keg here.
Yeah, at least she was trying. But clearly, you know, as a parent, there's been years of failures and probably in failing to get this child help. But also, I mean, this also raised other questions. I remember when we were discussing this about like, how much can you do sometimes to like help your child? Sometimes you just can't. Sometimes, and I, you know, I have in my family, I have a cousin who's an adult now, but you know, since she was very young, she's had a lot of serious mental health issues. The parents have tried lots of different things, all kinds of, you know, different medication. You can't control everything. You just can't, yeah. Unless you like institutionalize that child.
Yeah.
Like sometimes the parents actually are trying, but there's, no matter what you do, you just can't, there's just, you can't get the protections that you need around that child, you know, short of getting them incarcerated or institutionalizing them. And so, yeah, I'm curious. I mean, the father already got convicted, but let's see what that sentence comes down to. I would be shocked if he was actually sentenced to, like, you know, whatever, the maximum allowable. But anyway, when's the sentencing happening?
The trial just started, so we still have a bit.
Oh, he hasn't been convicted yet. He's just been trying. Oh, so he might not even get convicted.
We'll see.
Well, I take all that back. Well, yeah. That's going to, if there's any parents on that jury, good luck with that.
It'd be interesting jury composition of, you know, gun owners, parents. That's what the defense is going to be wanting in this case.
Out of Georgia.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, that's an interesting.
Yeah, it'll be tricky.
It'll be very. I'm actually surprised that the state is deciding to go forward with this. I think the odds are stacked against them. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for the stories, and thank you guys for listening. And if you have any ideas for us, always pop them in Facebook, DM us, let us know, and we will be back in a week.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.